VOA 1, the hits.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. Dr. Jill Robbins brings us the education report. Jonathan Evans will bring us a story about a sweet treat in Prague. And Susan Shand will talk about ancient Greek and Roman statues. I will return with this week's words and their stories. We will finish our 30 minutes together with Steve Ember and the making of a nation. But first, here is Dr. Jill Robbins.
This week, researchers released a report on LGBTQ+ students at schools in the United States. It found that almost all LGBTQ+ students who were questioned reported hearing offensive comments about their sexuality or gender identity. The GLSEN 2019 National School Climate Survey noted that they reported hearing comments such as, "That's so gay," on school playgrounds and in college dining halls. GLSEN is a national education and support group for members of the LGBTQ+ community. Teachers set up the group to provide support to individuals facing a hostile climate in school. LGBTQ+ is short for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer or questioning. The 2019 National School Climate Survey involved 16,700 students, all of them members of the LGBTQ+ community. They were questioned between April and August of last year. Just under 99% of those between 13 and 21 years of age reported hearing critical comments about their sexuality or gender identity. Almost 92% said the things they heard had made them feel distressed. Discussing LGBTQ+ issues in schools has led to fierce criticism in other countries. Last year, some parents in Britain protested the discussion of sexuality and gender identity in local schools. The GLSEN report surveyed students in all 50 U.S. states, as well as the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, American Samoa, and Guam. The results show that homophobia was common within educational organizations. More than 95% of those taking the survey said that they had heard hurtful comments about LGBTQ+ students at school. More than half the students reported hearing such comments, threats, or experiencing name-calling because of their sexual identity. 11% reported physical attacks because of their sexuality, the report noted. Eliza Byard is the executive director of GLSEN, a group formerly known as the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network. She said that the results show the need to continue to deal with the problem. "This is a very significant wake-up call about how the progress we've won is directly under attack." However, Byard notes that the situation now is very different from the past. "Where we are now is so different from where we were 20, 25 years ago in terms of how much better things are. On the other hand, where we are is clearly still unacceptable." One action GLSEN plans is No Name Calling Week from January 18th to the 22nd, 2021. The aim of the week is to end name calling and abuse in schools. Its organizers want students to learn how to be kind to one another. I'm Jill Robbins.
Now, here is Jonathan Evans.
A restaurant in Prague, Czech Republic, has invented a sweet treat shaped like the new coronavirus. The cake is an attempt to increase business, and it is already popular with diners. The Black Madonna restaurant has suffered as travel to the Czech Republic decreased because of the coronavirus health crisis. The country is battling one of the highest rates of coronavirus infections in Europe. The cake's creator, Olga Budnik, said she got the idea while most businesses in Prague were closed earlier this year. She told the Reuters news service, "I found a photo of the virus on the internet, and I figured out in detail how to make the dessert, how to make the spikes, what the color would be like, and I prepared it all." The cake is a little smaller than a tennis ball. It has a chocolate surface and is covered with cocoa butter. The virus's spikes are made of white chocolate and dried raspberries. Inside the cake is a nut filling with raspberry sauce and raspberries in the center. The cake has been a big success. The restaurant has been selling more than 100 each day. Wojtek Hermanek is the restaurant's marketing manager. He said, "The coronavirus crisis has caused a huge drop in business for Black Madonna and other Prague eateries." He added, "But at the same time, it was a chance to bring out the coronavirus cake, which is a symbol showing that not everything is lost." Olga Budnik said she is already looking ahead to the next product, a COVID-19 vaccination-themed sweet that tastes like lots of lime with a bit of alcohol. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Susan Shand brings us our next story.
Visitors to Rome can now see one of the most important private collections of ancient Greek and Roman marble sculptures. The 90 works from the Torlonia collection opened this week in the newly rebuilt Palazzo Caffarelli, overlooking the Roman Forum. Among the works is a marble fountain that was made in ancient Greece. Experts on ancient Rome believe the fountain once stood in the garden of the general and statesman Julius Caesar. At the time, It was already hundreds of years old. The 620-piece Torlonia collection is believed to be the greatest private collection of classical art in the world. It was begun more than a century ago by Prince Alessandro Torlonia. He found many of the pieces on the grounds of his family's Roman properties. Wealthy from a business relationship with the Vatican, the family purchased other well-known sculpture collections. In 1884, the prince built his own museum to show off his collection. When the museum closed in 1976, the pieces went into storage. The reappearance of such a collection is a very important event, said art historian Salvatore Settis. When I saw them for the first time, it was very emotional because I knew most of those pieces from books, but I had never seen them. The Torlonia family chose Settis to help with the difficult job of deciding which works should be shown to the public. Italy's culture minister, Dario Franceschini, said the works take your breath away. He spoke to reporters on Monday. The show will stay open until June 29, 2021. Show organizers said there had been plans to bring the artworks to other countries, but the coronavirus pandemic has left those plans uncertain. I'm Susan Shand.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. During autumn in many parts of the United States, you can watch squirrels gathering nuts for the winter. The squirrel puts the nut in its mouth, runs to a place it considers safe, digs a hole, and then drops the food in the ground. Hopefully, the animal will remember where it hid the nut weeks later. And all the while they do this, they look really funny. But it seems like a wise thing to do. Nuts are a healthy food source. They provide healthy fats and nutrients. That is, if you can break off the shell around the nut. The part of the nut we eat is protected by the shell, or nutshell. And that word is the basis for a common saying, in a nutshell. The expression, in a nutshell, means to provide important details in a short statement. If I give you information in a nutshell, I am describing the important parts of something in only a few words. We call this a summary. And that is the definition of in a nutshell, in a nutshell. Now let's talk a little more about those shells. They are usually hard to break open. Unless you are a squirrel, you need some sort of tool or device for cracking open the shells. And sometimes this is not very easy. In American English, the saying, a hard nut to crack, means something hard to understand. It can also describe an individual whose actions are perplexing. Why did she do that? What is he doing? How are they going to fix that? The expression, a hard nut to crack, can also describe someone who is simply difficult to deal with. Maybe her actions are confusing, or perhaps his behavior is unpredictable. Or we simply do not know how to deal with them. So we can say he or she is a hard nut to crack. You can use this expression for people, problems, or situations that are difficult to understand, solve, or deal with. When we use the expression, we can say tough instead of hard. Here, the two words mean the same thing, difficult. And that is our show for this week. In a nutshell, our intention here at VOA Learning English is to help you learn English. As you know, some English expressions can be tough nuts to crack. Make sure and join us again next week for another Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The 1850s were an increasingly tense time in the United States. Most of the population lived east of the Mississippi River, but more and more people were moving west. As western areas became populated, they became official territories and then new states. The settlement of these areas once again raised the issue of slavery. A law passed in 1820 called the Missouri Compromise extended a line across the map of the United States. Slavery was legal in areas south of the line. North of the line, slavery was illegal except in the state of Missouri. 30 years later, another political compromise made slavery a local issue instead of a national one. The Compromise of 1850 said people in the Western territories could decide for themselves whether slavery would be legal or illegal. Then, in 1854, Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas proposed another measure. His legislation would also affect slavery. It aimed to make the wild western area known as Nebraska an official territory.
This is the Great Plains. This is open territory. There were Indian tribes settled out there.
Nicole Etchison is an historian. She says white settlers could not move to Nebraska because a government did not yet exist there. They wanted the U.S. Congress to open the area to settlers. Investors wanted Congress to act, too, so Nebraska could support a railroad. Nebraska lies north of the line drawn by the Missouri Compromise of 1820. As a result, slavery would be banned in the territory. But slavery was permitted in the state next to Nebraska, Missouri. Slaveholders in Missouri did not want Nebraska to become a free territory. They were afraid their slaves would flee to it. They felt threatened by the free states and territories around them. So Senator Douglas proposed that the large Nebraska area be split in two. The northern part would be known as the Nebraska Territory. The southern part, next to Missouri, would be known as the Kansas Territory. The senator said that settlers in both territories had the right to decide whether their lands would accept slavery. He argued that the Compromise of 1850 had given the same right to people in two other territories, New Mexico and Utah. And he claimed that same right was meant for the people of all future territories. Douglas noted that in the past, the federal government sought to divide free states from slave states by making a line across a map. He said, dividing up land was not the answer. He said the people in a state or territory had the right to decide for themselves. This right was known as popular sovereignty. Historian Nicole Etchison says popular sovereignty required faith in the American political process.
Stephen Douglas argued that the foundation of American political philosophy is that the people get to decide, the voters get to decide issues, and there was no reason why they couldn't decide the slavery issue, just like they decided any other political issue.
Douglas argued that the Compromise of 1850 took the place of the Missouri Compromise of 1820. The new Kansas-Nebraska Act, he said, simply recognized the fact that the Missouri Compromise was dead. A number of anti-slavery senators denounced the Kansas-Nebraska bill. They said it was part of a Southern plan to spread slavery wherever possible. They also said Stephen Douglas was using the measure for political purposes. They said he wanted to be president and was hoping to influence voters in Southern states. Opposition to the Kansas-Nebraska bill was extremely strong in the northern states. In city after city, large public gatherings were held. Businessmen organized many of the meetings. They were angry at Douglas because he had reopened the dispute about slavery. They feared that the dispute would hurt the nation's economy. Northern religious leaders also united against the bill. Thousands signed protests and sent them to Congress. Douglas criticized the clergymen. He said they should stay out of politics. In the southern United States, the Kansas-Nebraska Act caused little excitement. Most southerners were not interested in it. They believed the measure might help the cause of slavery, but they also believed it might lead to trouble. President Franklin Pierce did not like the bill. He feared it would reopen the bitter national debate about slavery. However, most members of the U.S. Senate supported the Kansas-Nebraska bill. It passed easily in the Senate. The bill had less support in the House of Representatives. The vote there was close, but the measure passed. President Pierce finally agreed to sign it into law. In exchange, congressional leaders promised to approve several presidential appointments. Supporters of the Kansas-Nebraska Act celebrated its passage. They fired cannons as the city of Washington was waking to a new day. Two senators who opposed the bill heard the noise as they walked down the steps of the Capitol building. One of them said, "They celebrate a victory now, but the echoes they awake will never rest until slavery itself is dead." The new law gave the people of Kansas and Nebraska the right to decide if slavery would be legal or illegal. The vote would depend on who settled in the territories. It was not likely that people who owned slaves would settle in Nebraska. However, there was a good chance slave owners would settle in Kansas. Groups in the South organized quickly to help pro-slavery settlers move to Kansas. At the same time, groups in the North helped free state settlers move to Kansas. Historian Nicole Etchison says some of these settlers were abolitionists who believed slavery was wrong, but many were simply white farmers looking for new lands to settle. Ms. Etchison says These farmers did not care about slavery, but they did not want to live near blacks or compete with slave labor.
It's that third group of Midwesterners who becomes crucial, because when they get out there to Kansas and they can't get a fair vote, they become radicalized against slavery.
In Washington, President Pierce appointed Andrew Reeder as governor of the Kansas Territory. Pro-slavery settlers urged Reeder to hold immediate elections for a territorial legislature. They believed they were in the majority. They wanted a vote before too many free state settlers moved in. Governor Reeder rejected the demands. He decided to hold an election, but only for a territorial representative to the National Congress. On election day, hundreds of men from Missouri crossed the border into Kansas. They voted illegally, and the pro-slavery candidate won. The same thing happened when Kansas finally held an election for a legislature. Once again, men from Missouri crossed the border into Kansas. Many of them carried guns. They forced election officials to count their illegal votes. As a result, almost every pro-slavery candidate was elected to the new legislature. Nicole Etchison says many American elections in the 1800s had examples of violence, bad behavior, and wrongdoing. But the pro-slavery Missourians were extreme.
It was obvious that there was egregious fraud in the elections in Kansas Territory.
She says population counts at the time showed fewer than 3,000 voters in Kansas Territory. But pro-slavery candidates received up to 6,000 votes. The governor ordered an investigation. The investigation showed evidence of wrongdoing in six areas. New elections were held in those areas. This time, when only legal votes were counted, many of the pro-slavery candidates were defeated. Yet there were still enough pro-slavery candidates to hold a majority. Andrew Reeder understood he was governing a bitterly divided territory. He wanted to warn President Pierce about what was happening. So Reeder went to Washington. He met with Pierce almost every day for 2 weeks. He described how pro-slavery groups in Missouri were interfering in Kansas. He said, if the state of Missouri refused to deal with the troublemakers, then the national government must deal with them. He asked the president to do something. Pierce agreed that Kansas was a serious problem. He seemed ready to act. Reeder returned home and opened the first meeting of the territorial legislature. The pro-slavery majority quickly voted to move to a town close to the Missouri border. It also approved several pro-slavery measures. Governor Reeder vetoed these bills, but the legislature rejected his veto and passed the new laws. The Kansas legislature also sent a message to President Pierce. It wanted him to remove Reeder as governor. Political pressure was strong, and the president agreed. He named a new governor, Wilson Shannon. Shannon supported the pro-slavery laws of the legislature. He also said Kansas should become a slave state like Missouri. Kansas settlers, who had voted against slavery, became extremely angry. Soon, the situation became violent.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Anna Mateo.